You're listening to Raising Anchor, the Rhode Island FC podcast, now part of the Blazing Musket family. We're glad you're here. Hello and welcome to Raising Anchor, your podcast and source for all things Rhode Island FC. I'm your host, Matt Entrekin, coming to you on August 29th, Thursday as always. We're going to unpack the fifth 0-0 draw of the season and find out if this club is advancing towards their future destiny or about to revert to their distant past. Then we're going to get you ready for the second match of the season up against Coach Cano's former team, the Birmingham Legion, this Saturday at Burn Stadium. To do all of that and so much more, and I really mean so much more tonight, is the co-host with the most, Jason Carey. Jason, how is it going, my friend?
Good. I wonder what I have the most of. That we'll have to figure out some other time.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, we're, what, 73, 74 episodes deep at this point? So you've put in some time, so there's some mostest there. We won't get into the grammatics of it, but let's dive.
Yeah, we don't have time to catalog all of this.
No, not if we want to keep this sub 2 hours. Let's jump right into this and start off with some celebrations. And you know it, if you've been living under a rock, I don't know what to tell you. Koke Vegas named Team of the Week as the keeper in the sticks. Really interesting news here, though. Not only did he get the Team of the Week nod, but it's also coming off of his season-high five-save performance, which also included the late, and I mean very late, penalty save. We're going to talk about that a lot tonight. It saw him also lead the club's seventh clean sheet, and so we're going to break down that. It was a 0-0 draw, but, you know, not all things can be made whole. And more interestingly, Vegas is also the sixth player this season to earn the honor twice, including Jackson Lee, the other keeper on this team, who we had an interview with earlier this week. And I highly encourage you to go back and listen to that if you already haven't. Stephen Turnbull, Jojea Quizera, Albert Dequid, and Frank Nodarse. It's interesting, he's the 18th player overall to be nominated to the honor. But what's more interesting, too, is when I saw the stat about it being five saves and it was a record season high, he didn't beat his record on the season. He actually tied it. Do you know what game he tied for five saves of his own volition? Wasn't a clean sheet. I'll give you the hint there. But he's already had five saves on the season in a previous game. Any takers?
I don't know. I don't have a great memory. I would have to done my research ahead of time.
You'd also need the longest running memory because it was the very first game against New Mexico United in the inaugural match. So yeah,
that was a lifetime ago.
Right. I mean, you're not lying. So congratulations to Koke on the honor. And then in other honors, speaking of winners of multiple Team of the Week honors, Jojea Quizera gets named to the 35-man provisional roster for Rwanda in the AFCON qualifiers for 2025. It's a 35-man list. Nothing is set in stone. Provisional is provisional for a reason, right?
Yeah. So just a note on that, with provisional rosters, it means that it's not confirmed that he is going to be selected for the match day squad on, September 4th?
Yep.
It might impact his availability, the amount of minutes he plays this weekend. Some of that stuff we may not be privy to.
Yeah, and when we get into the match preview, we already kind of actually had a whole nother reason to put someone else in the spot. This kind of further doubles or even triples down on the likelihood that maybe we don't see him. We did see Quizera have a really important impact in Rwanda's team earlier at the initial qualifiers. So,
yeah, I think that means he's probably going to make that squad.
Right. So do you not get any minutes because you need to travel down? Do you extend your Labor Day weekend plans and maybe scoot out? Do you get a few minutes? Like, it'll be really interesting. We'll unpack that during the Birmingham preview. But before we get to that, and before we even get to the recap of the fifth 0-0 draw of the season, we got to talk Open Cup. USL is out, and it moves on. Some scandal, not on the Open Cup for the USL side, but just in general the Cup. But Indy 11, no more. USL is out.
Yeah, RIP Open Cup. Yeah, so Indy 11 lost 2-0 against Sporting Kansas City. They did as much as they could. I think Augie Williams probably, you know, had some nightmares about missing some tough chances. That's a long
flight or drive back, whatever that is, yeah.
You know, it was an interesting night, you know, because Don Garber used his evil genius weather machine to kind of put a storm over and delay the game.
Who knew weather could be the 12th man, right? I didn't know that. Did you actually stay up for it? Because I tried, and then at 10:30 when I realized the game wasn't still starting, I was like, hey, like, this is a Tuesday night. I've got things I gotta do in the morning.
I was spending some time with my wife. She just got home from a late shift. And then I kind of saw already that they scored, what, 30 minutes in-ish?
I think 16 and then 30, yeah.
And I was like, I'm hoping they're going to come back from this, but I'm not gonna stay up till, you know, what, midnight, 1 o'clock for this. I'll just hope that when I wake up, I get some good news, but unfortunately not. I do have to give a shout-out to the Sporting Kansas City supporters group, though. They did on the night display a TIFO that said "Save the Cup," and I think it's important for USL supporters to remember that, you know, these are fans who also do appreciate this cup competition. Our ire and anger should be directed to Don Garber and the owners. So there are a significant amount of fans who do not want to see this competition disappear.
Yeah, it'll be really curious to see what happens as a state of the Open Cup. I put a comment out there when I noticed the weather was going to delay the game by a significant amount of time, and I said, watch this be the talking point Don Garber uses later in the end of the season when they say, oh, we tried to find a viable path to save the cup, but the attendance was so low in a semifinal, like only 6,000 people watched because the East Coast didn't start till 11 p.m. on a Tuesday, right? Like, I could see the talking point canning itself for Don Garber to use later. We'll see what happens. Again, they should already have the plan segmented and ready to go because the amateur teams are already qualifying for next year's tournament. So it's not like they can't roll that kind of red carpet out already and have that figured out.
Yeah, there's this weird position where I want to support the cup, and then so that means I should watch the final, but at the same time, it's two MLS teams and I don't really...
Well, so here's the thing. I still want to watch it, but I hate how LAFC got into their positioning on it. I went back and watched that game, and I hate it when a game comes down to a very close penalty decision, and it's one of those ones where it's so close that I don't even know if they use VAR in Open Cup. I know they have the technology.
Probably
there.
Not, I would imagine, because you would have to guarantee it at different levels, and you can't guarantee that depending on who's hosting the game.
I agree. And like, the problem to me was I saw it and the handball that caused the penalty, very questionable. It's so close, I can see both arguments. It's not how I want a game of that magnitude to be decided. And I went back and also looked at LAFC's record this year. They have a lot of penalty calls going their way this year. I'm not saying that there are refs being paid off, that this isn't a Barca situation.
Sometimes
it's a
just
Barca
luck.
Situation.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's that. So if you're going to watch the Open Cup, curious what people think about the ending result. If LAFC does win, it still doesn't help us because USL is not in a position to benefit from that.
You know, Indy did their best. It was accomplishment to make it that far, but unfortunately it just wasn't in the cards for them.
Wasn't in the cards indeed. All right, let's get into the Open, or not the Open Cup, we already did that. Let's get into this Loudon match. I'm going to save it, but I have, if we win against Loudon on the second leg when they come home, I have a very special tweet saved, ready to go. I was ready to use it on this game. Didn't get the chance. That's the biggest personal loss on the night. But let's start unpacking this, and let's start with the formation, including we're going to start adding the bench, because I think as we start to progress, it's going to be important that we also talk about not just who started, but also who was kind of in the auxiliary roles.
Yeah,
on
because
the night.
There's always a few names that get left out there. So we saw Vegas in goal as usual, but we did see a change in the back line. We saw Dugan getting his, what, first start here, right? With Yao and Stoneman in the back, which means Nodarce was left on the bench. Then you've got Turnbull, Hosted, Ibarra, Quisera, and Fuson with Chico and Doyle up top. And then, like you mentioned, on the bench, you've got Williams, McGlynn, Brito, Nodarce, Alves, Smith, and Lee.
Yeah, we knew that Dugan was going to break into this at some point. We just didn't know that it would happen this quick. I think we also knew, based on Kano's remarks, that we would see Dugan take on the responsibility of that left center back role in that position because he's a naturally left-footed defender, and you know, coach couldn't sing his praises high enough. So we knew that he would displace Frank Nodarce, but we didn't think Frank would actually be displaced from the starting 11. I think if you took like a guaranteed bet to be wrong, I think a lot of people would have said, hey, you move Nodarce to either the center back or you move him to the right back side of things. And given the relationship that Koke has with Grant Stoneman, and then also the fact that, you know, of all the players, Yao has shown the most incredible tackles and defensive emergency moves. He's also kind of at times been the, you could tell it, whether it was by his speed or some of his questionable, like where he comes off of his line, it was kind of like Yao's game to lose, but that's not the case. Nodarce does not find a spot on that starting 11. Is this a sign of the tide changing directions? Do we think that this is something that's going to be something that Kano has to answer for? Because like, you cannot, Nodarce was, by the stats, by the eyeball, he has been the most consistent defender with the most minutes and probably the best person in that starting 11. And now he did not get those minutes.
Yeah, it's one match, so it'd be hard to tell going forward. I think that we initially had thought we were going to see Yao lose the spot. But when but prior to this match, if you took a snapshot of minutes played, Nodarce has the most in the entire squad. So I imagine coach, to a certain extent, probably wanted to give him rest as well as give Dugan a shot to show him, like, you know, show me what you can do. Dugan being left-footed slotted very well into a left center back role, where Nodarce's done well also. So we'll see Nodarce either in the center or on the right. I'm not sure which one Stoneman probably prefers, but we'll figure that out going forward. And then also on the night, I think Dugan showed off his passing ability, which is very good. He's able to hit very long, like cross field balls very accurately.
Yeah, and that's the other problem too. Right? It may have been a 0-0, but that means it was a clean sheet. And Rhode Island FC absolutely put in a defensive performance on the night, not just Koke Vegas. So it's even harder now for Nodarce to lose his spot on a night where there were no goals, there were no real mistakes made. We'll talk about the penalty in a minute, but it's tough to say. Now, a lot of people asked us afterwards and through the week because they saw that in the previous game, Frank Nodarce had picked up a yellow card. So they thought, oh, maybe this is coach playing 4D chess and doing this for the ability to roll back a card for good performances on the day. So similar to when we did the Clay Holstead exercise, up on the screen, we have Frank Nodarce's actual yellow card accumulation count. So yes, he is at 7 cards and he should be sent off for disciplinary reasons on the next card. However, we went back and tracked the stats and he's actually at a placeholder right now of 4 yellow cards. So he got his first yellow card against the Charleston Battery at home. And then he had 3 immediate cards, which reversed that one. And then he picked up a yellow card against North Carolina FC. He had 3 again where he got his yellow rescinded against Louisville, picked it up immediately in the El Paso game, and then went on a 3-game streak of yellow card accumulation to get 3 after Miami. He picked up another one in North Carolina, bringing him to 4. And then after the Hartford game, he rolled back the clock, so to speak, on another one before picking one up against the Oakland Roots. So he is at 4 right now, and he has one more good behavior that he can rotate through.
Maximizing those Uno reverse cards there.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting too, actually, is in the streak between Charleston and the North Carolina, he actually had a string of 6 or 7 games where he played a clean game. The problem is you can't like bank good behaviors for future yellow cards. It has to have one already earned to roll back the clock. So that's where unfortunately he landed on that. So that means though to me that there is no disciplinary issue. The only thing it could be is that Dugan's the better defender, which that's a bold statement to make, or that he, because Frank has played so many minutes, the most minutes actually, that maybe it was more of a, let's give him a rest and break. It still doesn't make it any easier to figure out the roster for this weekend. And we're going to try our best in a minute to do that. But it's going, like, you can feel around the rest of the positions and kind of rotate players and go, okay, I kind of see where you're coming from. Thinking that Frank Nodarce is now on the wrong side of coach's decision making, it's just a crazy concept to think about.
Yeah, now that we have 4 actual out and out center backs, I think it just gives us better option for rotation. instead of having to like push Clay back there or anyone else who doesn't really need to be playing in those positions.
I mean, look at Kofi Tchimessi. He put in an incredible shift at the right center back role for a while before his injury, but that's not a position he was supposed to be playing. So I'd love to see him be able to mix things up in the midfield and see what opportunities he brings when he returns to the squad. So let's get into these stats. You see them on the screen. We've got them all listed out. I want to go through kind of the quick talking points just to kind of get some of the newsworthy bites out of the way. Like you said, Morris Dugan does get his first career USL Championship start. And it was the only change between the formations with Oakland Roots and then this Loudoun game. Like we mentioned, Koke Vegas with his five saves. It was his fourth clean sheet. So when we talked earlier about the seven total that RIFC has earned, Jackson Lee and him were tied with three clean sheets apiece. Koke has now converted one extra one, so he's leading the category. And then Chico actually got five shots, tying the highest single match tally for a player in Rhode Island FC history. So we're also going to talk about, you know, that's shots, that's not goals, or maybe shots on target, but nevertheless, shots. The interesting thing here with the performance on the night is the scoreless tie was Rhode Island FC's fifth one, but it led to the 13th overall draw king special. And I know there's a lot of people that are asking, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And we have some very interesting inaugural stats that we can't wait to share with you guys a little bit earlier this week, this episode. But finally, I do want to say that the last time RIFC was scoreless in a 0-0 performance, it's been since May 25th. That is a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while. We kind of front-loaded a lot of those early on in the season. And now that, you know, for the most part, up until maybe this last match, RIFC haven't really had trouble scoring. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. We're going to answer that question, Jason, a little bit later in the pod on whether or not AST is going to be in the match. We've got Matthew Jean, birthday boy Matthew Jean, writing in. His name is Albert until he scores a goal again. That's also another interesting thing, which we'll talk about in that segment. But we got other things to move through here first. But we were at the Guild together. Great turnout, as always, by Defiant 1636. Not the result we wanted to see. Just nil-nils don't always bring excitement. There were moments, whether it was the missed conversion from Zach Ryan at Loudoun on the penalty or just the missed opportunities from Chico and Doyle. Talk me through, what were your initial impressions on the game?
Yeah, so before we jump into like the main talking points, if we just kind of summarize this, I think from our perspective, it was a frustrating draw, right? This time, though, if we compare it to the previous draw against Oakland, I think a lot of that was the opposition's shenanigans that we didn't have any control over. This time it felt like there was maybe potential for the game to be won there, but you know, the shooting was just a bit off. So I'd say we can kind of give them a pass here, but that's two draws in a row. You know, are we in a bit of a slump? Maybe. It's hard to tell. I think that depending on the result this weekend, you know, two matches, fine. If it becomes a third, then I think we would start to have to worry. But, you know, we'll get there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does feel like it's a certain regression to the mean. We haven't seen these types of shotless performances, low goal scoring productions in quite a while. There was an 8-game streak where we scored multiple goals, per game, from anywhere as low as 2 to 5 goals in a match. So it can be a bit frustrating for fans, especially in this inaugural season, to suddenly be like, wait, are we right back to where we were on May 25th when we were stringing together multiple draws and multiple 0-0 draws at the same time? And, you know, what's frustrating on the night, you know, I put the stats back up on the screen, is that overall the team performed above, again, and this team typically does, and at least in the stats columns, they outperformed their opponent. It all just comes down to the clinicalness of the finishing opportunities from the strikers.
Yeah, and there's basically one stat that stands out right there, and that's shot on target, which is 3. If you have 15 shots and you only get 3 on target, I mean, it's going to be tough to convert those small opportunities there.
Yeah, so we'll get into Chico's troubles in a second and maybe the implications that could happen from that. But the one thing I was really proud of this team, just to start things off, because it's hard to take the silver linings outside of the clean sheet, I was still really impressed that we didn't fall into letting Loudoun dictate terms at Segra Field. We've warned multiple times that possession is the Achilles heel of this team, as coach has really leaned into the transition counter style. And Loudon tried multiple times to get us to like bring the ball out, and we wouldn't do that. If we didn't find an option, we'd play indirectly and go wide and try to reset, but we would never try to force something on the night. You know, when my favorite thing to ask you after any game is like, what was the possession breakdown? What was, you know, what was the tilt? Because when the tilt is in our favor and we're almost always in the enemy's third, we do significantly better. When it's in our half, when we're holding onto the ball too long, we typically become stagnant and we don't do well. And when you looked, you'd notice that 48% of the match was basically fought in the midfield, which I'm fine with. If the game is determined near the half line, like that is totally fine with me, as long as we're not holding onto the ball in our back half. And you saw that with us having less possession on the night, and you saw that like if we couldn't get things into their final third, we always most of the time stopped the ball in that midfield line. It was a really good performance from Clay Holsted and Mark Ibarra, as well as the back three, on making sure that like if they moved the ball up, they did not get many opportunities to advance.
One more quick thought before we move on. We had also talked about RAFC having slow starts. I think they started this match pretty well. Like within a minute, we had that shot on net, forced a save, and then we have that that Chico chance from that cross, the Doyle cross. I think that was in the first half, maybe 20-ish minutes. So there's a few opportunities early on that we kind of pressed. Maybe that's why towards the end of the match we were kind of falling off. I don't know. But, you know, it's better than it has been in the past.
No, I completely agree. So let's get into the most controversial part of the night, and that was the penalties, right? And when I say penalties, I mean it because depending on who you ask, some people say that there was only one penalty on the night. Some people say there were two penalties on the night. Some people will say there are three penalties.
I mean, there's only one that's been called.
Correct. And even then, that one maybe probably should not have been called either. So obviously this will all tie into Koke's performance, but I want to talk about the penalties themselves. So I actually went into Loudon's kind of boards and stuff to understand what their feelings and impressions were from the game. And a lot of people in the Loudon camp will say that the referee was overcorrecting for the penalty that he did reward for an instance where Loudon was, you know, and I use air quotes here, deserved of a penalty opportunity in the 59th minute where he missed a call. I went back and I actually didn't just watch like the USL broadcast. I pulled the video and then used like premium video editing software tools because you can slow it down, you can zoom in then a lot better. And I watched the whole sequence and I understand their ire and they're upset, but I want to set the record straight. So what they're claiming is that when in the 59th minute, a ball came in for a cross and Leggett tried to put his foot to a bouncing volley. And he was like danger close. He was like a yard off of the box. The problem was is he had to get through Dugan to get to it. So he wrapped himself around Dugan to try and do something with it. Well, when bodies start to kind of intertwine like that, it starts to not look so great in front of a ref. So Dugan starts backpedaling away, but Leggett is wrapped around him. So Leggett falls, and he instantly starts trying to sell contact made and that he was denied an opportunity to score a goal. The problem is Koke punches the ball away, and it's falling in tandem with Dugan, who is on his back foot trying to, like, he's just trying to stay up. He's just trying to stay vertical, and he's failing miserably at that. So the ball's coming right at him. It almost hits him in the high arm, similar to the Open Cup penalty, and he misses. Like, he barely gets, like, Matrix dodges it. And so the ball falls under his arm, but he's still falling down to the ground, and he sees Zach Ryan coming up into the box ready just to bury this shot. So in the last second, as he's about to fall to the ground, he just kicks out, and it's all ball. I watched it several times. He kicks out, deflects the ball off to the side, but Zach Ryan brings his shooting foot through, trailing it and acting, and you see him like leapfrog and just dive over Dugan to try to sell the PK. Ref's not having it, which again just makes me wonder about like simulation versus like contact and foul, because Dugan was falling backwards with an extended leg. Ryan's coming over the top. That's like, that is not contact. So it's either, again, like that's a foul and that's a penalty, or that's simulation and Ryan should have gotten a card. But anyways, go ahead.
In those circumstances, I didn't use any editing software, but I did go back and rewatch it a few times. And it's a bunch of chaos right there, right? Sometimes it's a physical sport. It's a contact sport. Sometimes there are just coming togethers. And I don't really see a penalty there. It's just a bit of chaos.
Right. So now what I don't know is if that was the first bit of ammunition to fuel this ref making the decision he makes later, or if it's this second instance now where Chico in the 79th minute catches a fast break from a JJ Williams flick on and he's off to the races. But as he receives the ball, instead of just volleying it, which in hindsight, you know, you can say whatever you wanted as an observer of the game, but instead of just shooting, he tries to collect the ball and advance in a few additional steps into the box. But he has a bad touch on it, which allows, I forget which defender for Loudon, to catch up and just complete a slide tackle and just create a wall in front of Chico as he attempts to shoot a little closer in. The ball clearly deflects off of the player. It's a clean tackle, but Chico carries his foot through and then acts as if contact was made and starts to simulate his own kind of dive, if you will. And on the one side, I appreciate the effort, the salesmanship. On the downside of it, I don't appreciate that. I think this is the third or fourth time we've tried to watch him do this kind of behavior. And I know that sometimes when you can produce goals out of nothing, it works in your favor. Dennis Bouanga for LAFC is notorious for doing this, and he gets a high conversion rate for it because he's fast and it looks legit most of the time. Chico needs to work on his embellishment, or I guess not work on his embellishment, but reduce his embellishment a little bit more to sell it. And so it didn't look good. But to his credit, I think he realized even he wasn't going to sell it well. So as soon as he started the initiation on the flop, he like dove onto his knees and then got back up because he realized the ball was loose and there may have been another chance to convert for a shot. It didn't go anywhere. But you know that ref has now watched potentially Dugan make a penalty that he couldn't call, and now he's watched Rhode Island FC quote unquote flop one that he didn't call. So I think either one or the other or both may have contributed with what we saw next on the night.
It's hard to say. I didn't think too much of that. You know, that there, I forget what game it was. There was a game back then that I do remember Chico felt like he really was embellishing the contact. In terms of this one, sometimes the way you run, maybe he was just dragging his feet. I'd give him the benefit of the doubt. With replay and slow motion, you can make a lot of challenges and tackles and whatnot look bad. And honestly, the way coach was really upset about Oakland, like in their antics, I think that if Chico was doing this stuff, I don't think coach would approve, and I think that he would have a talk with him. So I think it's just one of those, you know, he thought he was going to get to it. He dragged his foot a bit, fell over, and he gets up and moves on.
Okay. I mean, I don't know what was in the mind of the referee. All I know is next, he makes a complete blunder of it as in the stoppage time, 90th plus, Gavin Turner creates the softest flop I've seen so far in the USL. He's at the top of the box, collects a short cross. It's a high ball. It bounces off of his shoulder. He brings it down, and Jojea Quizera, he's not running at him at full speed. He just sees that there's a gap, and he's inside the top corner of the box. So Jojea comes to close it down. Now, Jojea, all he does is put a foot out. He's not running through or running at. He's just trying to make sure that he closes down any shooting lanes that Turner will have open to him. So he starts to step through so that the ball can't get under him. Turner, in a good attempt, it didn't work out. He tries to flick the ball over into the right, so back out to the far post, away from Quizera. Quizera doesn't do anything other than just finally place his foot down where he always intended to do it. Turner takes one step forward and like leaps into Jojea Quizera and then makes the contact, and there's very little, and then instantly has the body just turn and he rotates and he's on the ground. Two seconds later, Quizera is booked and there's a penalty. Actually, sorry, Quizera was already booked. There's just a penalty offered. And I mean, listen, contact, there has to be some physicality and connection when it comes to contact. That's not what this was. This is a completely bad call. If this had been given to us, I would have said, I'll take it. But I would never be proud of that call. I mean, I'd be proud of the salesmanship again, back to like what Chico needs to work on, but that's never a penalty.
Yeah, I think it was a very soft PK. When you look at it, he is Gavin Turner. He's initiating the contact. I think when I went back and checked it, it doesn't help that Jojea kind of just stands there and does the thing where he puts his hands up like, I didn't do anything, as opposed to just
like
ignoring,
not even that,
just ignore that it even happened, like as he's flopping, and then just continue to play soccer. I don't know if that would have changed the ref's mind, but anyone who just always puts their hands up after something, it feels like they're saying, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything.
So
like,
what
they're
I'm
guilty.
Hearing is we need to work on how to sell getting a penalty, and then we need to also work on selling how we didn't contribute to a penalty.
Yeah, just let him roll around on the floor, continue, go after the ball, try and clear it. Like, just continue to play. Let him do whatever he's going to do.
Coach, use that RIFC budget, and let's get some PPAC acting classes ASAP to the team.
You know, it's like the old days when you know, Pepe or Ramos would just murder someone on the pitch and they just put their hands up. I didn't do anything.
Was that Nigel de Jong dropkick in the World Cup? Yeah, he fell into my foot.
You know, in hindsight, the penalty was saved. So
the ball never lies.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, rap fans across the world, I will say it, the ball never lies.
I was also really glad to not see that go in because... Did you notice Zachary Ryan was kind of, I don't know if it was arrogance or he was taunting us. He was just standing there by the penalty spot, juggling the ball instead of, you know, placing the position and trying to get yourself in the mindset. He's just like, oh, I'm so cool. Look at me.
I do this all the time.
Look at my juggling skills.
I do this all the time.
And JJ walked up and tried to swipe the ball out of his hand, and then he just kind of stopped.
So
and also stutter step penalties are the worst. They should be banned.
So I'm just going to get this out there. We're going to talk about this now for Koke. But what if I told you that there's a reason that Koke Vegas saved that, and it wasn't luck, and it wasn't this. There was some people online saying he stepped off his line too early, so he cheated. We'll never know that.
No, I mean, it's Emmy Martinez.
But what if I told you that it wasn't just luck? What if I told you it was planned, like divination, providence, whatever you want to call it? You know why?
Why is that?
Koke knows his stuff. On the screen, for those of you watching along, is Zach Ryan's shooting record in the last year and a half of his penalty takes. So keepers, to my understanding, when they watch tape, one of the things they do is they understand someone out there is monitoring where is the normal path of a disciplined penalty converter or penalty taker. And Zach Ryan is a one-trick pony. And all he ever does is go left.
Yeah, so for those listening at home, it would be the keeper's right. There's only one that looks like it's kind of down the middle, but all the other penalties are to the keeper's right.
Yeah, so and this is a five-shot spread. So I won't say Vegas was armed and could kind of predict it, but at the same time, he absolutely did. And listen, full credit to Koke Vegas. Our shooters were cold. His gloves were hot, like red hot. So... on top of the four shots that he denied, including then that penalty conversion, you love to see this man, as the capitan himself, doing all of the work to finally get the credit. Because like sometimes goalkeeping can be a thankless job. We talked about that with Jackson Lee. Like there's so much, like a striker's life is perfect. Just try, you get one, and it's like you are the best person ever. A keeper, on the other hand...
touch the ball three times, score it.
Be perfect all night. If you make one mistake, you are going to be ridiculed, punished, and like remembered forever for being terrible. Like it is such an unfair position that keepers are put in. So I'm incredibly proud of Koke. What did you think? Not just on the penalty on the night, just his overall performance. What did you think?
Yeah, overall, Koke was great on the night. You know, shout out to the back line as well, too. That it is very much a team, and he and all other goalkeepers will say, hey, without my back line, I can't do this. I mean, even if we're moving further up, I think our midfield did fairly well too this match. It couldn't seem like we get that goal production going. And sometimes that's just how it plays out.
Yeah. Speaking of penalty kick takers, obviously Chico, who I don't want to beat up too much tonight, not one of our best penalty takers. Once I found out I could start to pull these stats and this data, I of course took it and applied the same mechanics to Rhode Island FC. So for those of you listening along that want to participate, this question's for everyone. But Jason, I'm going to ask you, if Rhode Island FC was to designate a player on the field, who is our most dangerous and lethal penalty kick taker in terms of conversion and number of kicks actually scored?
I saw this in the notes. I could have cheated and looked it up.
I did not leave the name.
I could have just done the research myself.
Maybe. That's true.
So
we've got Joe Brito.
I've got two guesses. They're probably wrong.
Okay.
I was thinking either Mark Ibarra or Clay Holstead.
Okay. So it is not Mark Ibarra. It is not Clay Holstead. It is not Joe Brito. And we know it's not Chico. I'm going to give it one extra second not to put too much like empty radio time, so to speak, on.
No, if you saw it.
So if anyone else wants to throw a guess in, I see JJ in there. It's not JJ. Any last guesses?
Coach Cano?
I mean, Coach probably is the highest. I didn't run his stats for his early 2000s MLS record. Jason writes in, don't say it's Doyle. Well, Jason, too bad, because it is absolutely... Mark Doyle.
I should have known.
Penalty kick deluxe. And of course, right? Like, you know, he's going, all of our striker team is going through some problems right now. But Mark Doyle has converted his last 7 penalty opportunities. And unless it's just a terrible experience in the Ireland divisions, he can do it. So it's Mark Doyle should be our number one shot taker. Mm. Noah Fusson is also very good, but Noah doesn't have nearly the amount of attempts in big moment games, so it's hard to say that Noah could do it, but it'd be either you'd want Noah or Doyle to take those. So in case Coach hasn't run those data statistics, I'm just helping him out, you know, making sure he's well-armed for those moments.
There you go.
We don't get a lot of penalties our way. So, but speaking of Doyle, let's talk about Doyle because there's been a bit of some frustration from what it looks like fans on understanding why does Doyle keep getting the start instead of JJ Williams. So I'm going to start with you. Why is Doyle getting the nod instead of JJ Williams?
I think that it has to, you know, Williams the last few matches is maybe not passing the eye test as much. He seems to be in a bit of a funk. When he came back from his long injury, his physicality has brought a new dimension to the team. He's picked up a few assists, but as of late, it seems like, you know, some of his decision-making, his passes, touch and shots, like remember he took a shot that kind of just skied and...
You mean the shot at the end of the game where he was just I have to get one shot on my resume for the day, so I'm just going to fire one off.
Everything just seems to be slightly off. And despite not having a goal to his name, Doyle has played fairly well of late. He also can kind of do that dual thing that Fusson also does, where he can go out wide and send crosses into. So he adds a bit of like dynamic ability to that front. So I just think that as of late, he's been a little better. That being said, I think if we're just counting the last few matches, it seems like that there is some trouble up front, and maybe it'll just pass. Maybe it's just a little blip. Maybe to a certain extent we were outscoring our XG productions. Maybe this is a regression to the means.
How dare you? This is not the time machine.
I'm just throwing the thought out there. You know, like I said, without another match or two under a belt to kind of get some better data, I'm just gonna like forget about it for now. But you know, when you have two draws in a row that both were kind of frustrating, sometimes maybe it makes you start thinking.
I think that it is an apples to oranges comparison at the end of the day, because each one of these forwards offers a completely different, unique skill set. And I think that naturally they were supposed to be playing together on the pitch, not fighting for one of the two forward spots. I've said this a million times. I think Chico ruined all of those plans because I think it was going to be Fusson, Doyle and JJ as the primary driver of a 4-3-3 that we'll never see except for in like scrimmage that will never happen in front of a public setting.
Allegedly.
Oh, right. But I do want to say that I pulled Doyle's numbers and compared them against JJ's. Now, Doyle has more goals on the season than JJ Williams. It's 2-1, but JJ Williams has significantly higher goal contribution totals because he's been an assist machine for us this season with 4 assists as well. So he's outproducing by a ratio of 5-2. But when you look at the minutes total between the two players, Doyle's only had about 460 minutes on the season. JJ Williams, which is crazy thinking he missed so many games at the beginning, he's already over 1,000 minutes. He's at 1,100 minutes. In that time, Doyle has had more shots on target. He's had a higher shooting accuracy by almost 15%. He has also led in key passes. He's reduced his offside footprint. He's had more successful passes. His passing accuracy, and this is the damaging one, to where I think if we're going to say that JJ Williams is this like target forward, false nine, to like collect the ball, head it on, body something, draw defenders in and move the ball away, I think this is the stat that really hurts. His passing accuracy is less than 50%. So when you're making that final third attempt and you're not connecting to the oncoming winger, the oncoming striker, the midfielder, whatever it is, like that's a terrible spot to be in. Now, that's a byproduct of these long balls that come to him and he can't move them along. So it's not a fair stat. But like others have said in the chat, I just think that they offer two different things. And so really it comes down to, what do you need on the night? Do you need a body in the center of the field to throw balls at and see what you can scoop up? Look at Chico's performance. All the other ones that we're talking about, the one where he had the best look of something he created was when JJ Williams flicked on a pass. Like, JJ has the tool set. I don't think we're going to see a lot of goals out of this guy based on how we've set up this team outside of set pieces and corners. And then there's taller people that are not as dangerous to like defenders on the opposite team. Like, they're more worried about JJ Williams. They're not worried about Grant Stoneman or Frank Nadarsi. They should be, because Frank's second, I think, still in goal scoring. But they're like, where's JJ Williams? Do we need to single man mark him? Do we need to double up on him? And that's a problem. So I don't know what it is. I've heard that Mark Doyle is also benefiting right now from having amazing training practices and sessions in practice. Like, if you're doing incredible in practice, it's like FIFA career mode, right? Like, how do you get on the starting bench for your premier team? Well, yeah, you're a rated 63 player, but you're doing every single skill, you're doing every single dribble set, you're making yourself invaluable that you have to be picked on. So like, they're fighting over the same spot. And if Mark Doyle is showing up better on the day, or he's producing things that coach wants to see, it's hard to just say for JJ Williams, well, you need me because I'm the body. Like, it's not always going to be the thing that works. And when a team figures out how to block out, or I should say box out even JJ Williams, it becomes really difficult.
Yeah, I guess on the night, it's just going to be important for them to, with whatever minutes they are given, to show coach that they need to be on the pitch.
I couldn't agree with you more. So let's talk about the man of the hour, if it wasn't Koke Vegas, and that would be one Albert Deco. We won't use his name for those that have already requested. Albert's going to want that. He's going to want a lot of things back, whether it's the second minute or it's the 21st minute, which was the really bad one, the damaging one, where there's no one blocking it except for apparently the wind, as he skied a ball up into the rafters of Segra Field. I think more shots went above the goal than at it or to the side of it. It was a lot of aerial, like the wrong kind of goals were attempted at that field. Those are field goals, not the regular goals.
Yeah. So Chico had six shots, and six of those were in the box, which is good. The problem is that only one of them was on target. Like we'd mentioned earlier, only three shots on target in the whole match, which is not great. If you want to score a goal, you're going to need to convert more than that. It's funny, you know, we saw Chico showing off his Arsenal kit. And if this is a dress for the job you want kind of situation, I think he's going to have to get a few more shots on frame if he's going to get that call up from Arteta.
It's so good too, because if you're looking along on the screen, you're right, 15 shots, 9 shots inside the box, 3 shots on target. I highlighted them, but I didn't do a good job, so on the next visual I'll work on it. But you can see one is in the 6-yard, one is on the outside of it, and then one is way outside of the box. The close one in the 6-yard is Doyle's attempt to convert. The one in the box, but beyond the 6-yard box, that is the one that Deke will put on target. So remember that big fat circle you see in the middle there, that's the one that never made it. Just went straight over the top. And then the tiny circle that you see out in the way back side there, that's Clay Holsted trying to just only shoot bangers. So in fact, so much so, there's another one, which I can't show on the screen, But at the very bottom, almost to the halfway line, that's another Clay Holsted banger where he tried to catch the keeper sleeping. He almost got it, but it wasn't enough at the end of the day.
Yeah, and we talked about this before, not to harp on it too much. These three shots are mostly center-ish, so
they're not challenging.
They're not challenging the keeper too much. You know, you're going to want to look for pass backs and things like that to kind of move and draw the keeper to one side if you're going to be able to kind of shoot down the middle there. And it just wasn't working on the night.
Yeah, you know, the only thing I'll say is the last time we saw Chico botch something this bad was the Phoenix failed penalty conversion. And that went on to lead to a 7-game drought for him. He even got benched for a game. We don't know if it was for an actual injury or if it was just his performance wasn't there. I'm not sure if Chico's the type of player that gets into his own headspace and then starts having poor performances afterwards. But right now, my biggest concern isn't the actual result on the night, but it's his headspace.
Yeah, because last pod, we were talking about how, you know, he's made it to 10 goal contributions, and we think that he is kind of heading in the right direction. So the important thing is, at the end of the day, it is what it is. The match is done. We're not here to beat up on him. We just hope that he isn't sitting at home thinking, I should have put that on target. Because as long as he just, you know, continues to do what he has been doing, goals and assists are going to keep coming his way.
Yeah. So if you see Chico out in the wild this week, give him a hug, give him a thumbs up. Make sure you ask for the hug first. Don't just come up and hug him. That always probably doesn't work out well for players. But just tell him that you love him. Tell him that you appreciate everything he does and that you know he'll bounce back from this. And it's just one game and that he's your favorite player. Even if he's not your favorite player, just tell him that to give him all the confidence. Strikers are so fickle about, like, not even fickle, like streaky, like the whole like mentality, like they can do incredible things 1 minute, and then if they get in their own headspace, they just can become completely discombobulated. So, you know, and it's a concern, right? Because JJ is clearly in a rut of some sort. Doyle, right place, right time, but not always doing what we need. Flo Bros are out of commission. Maybe only one of them now. We'll talk about that in a second. Like, we've only got Fusan left and Clay Holsted at 18 yards or greater. So it is, and Air Frank's not on the starting 11. Like, We gotta figure this out. We just gotta figure this out a little bit.
Yeah. You know, when we look more into the match and talk about our transition play and whatnot, this team doesn't do too well with too much possession. We did find ourselves with a lot of possession on the night. They often kind of look lost and don't know how to build up. Most of our attack is, as of late, has been kind of coming down the wings, right? We do various combinations, kind of move down to either Jorge or Steven, but Loudon actually made that very difficult for us on the night. Tingey and Dambrot did very well to kind of mark both of them. So if you go back and look at the positioning, those players are just right on top of each other. So yeah. What happened is, instead of being able to use those outlets, you saw a lot of possession in the back and we're trying to kind of break through the middle. And that's just not normally something we've been great up as of late. You know, RIP Jack Paniotu. But what happens every game
he's at refs too, I just get a little bit more hope. You know, just imagine getting him back like 2 games before the playoffs. Oh.
What's frustrating is that you see that the team maybe doesn't have a great plan B at times. And then they try to force a pass. But then there's too many of our players on the night were being very static. There wasn't enough movement and space to kind of receive the ball. And it just felt like they were standing there waiting for the ball to come to them.
Yeah, you know, and I'm so glad you say that, because that was the thing that, like, sometimes you go into the stats, you try to, like, look at individual attributes, and you try to, like, figure out what's the combination of things that are going right or wrong in a player's game. And it was for the first time, because there was, and the game wasn't boring, but like when you kind of kept seeing the same effort and there was nothing being given on either side, I realized that I think I at least agree with you, and I'd love to know if listeners agree with this. I think we've unlocked the transition problem of what's happening here with this team. It's not that they can't be a build-up team. It's the reason that they look better on counterattack is because in those moments, they're playing with the momentum of the ball. They are trying to capitalize on an advantage or they're trying to capitalize on a big chance that's going to be created by this quick offset. And they're running into lanes. They're running into spaces. They are trying to capitalize on this momentum. When they build up out of the back, I hadn't seen it before. I almost want to go back and watch a few games to see if this is a real thing. But we play very direct to the feet instead of playing into lanes or to play into options for that ability to destabilize either the midfield or their back line, meaning that like Clay is just standing there waiting for the ball. He's not running. He's saving energy, but he's not like running into space to have a through ball or a cut line come in and collect at his feet to do something different. And that happens a lot in our central midfield, including the likes of if one of our strikers drops in, we kind of just sit there. And whether that's to hold the opposing team's position and form so that we can do something else, that I won't pretend I'm a brilliant tactician. But like outside of our wingers, if we don't have momentum going our way, it becomes very stagnant. They look like traffic cones to like dribble around versus like creating offsets or relief. And the same thing happens too when the ball... When any kind of play starts to stagnate, they all just kind of break down and stop, and they even stop on each other. There were several times in this game where we had three players like within handshaking range, and that wasn't going to do. And this wasn't like on a goal opportunity. This was just like they were at the top of the box and they were all center profile. It was like Clay Holsted, Fusan, and I think Doyle were all just standing next to each other. Like that's never going to help the team. And I get it. You can't run 90 minutes 100%. But I think one of the things that's really interesting, either this team has like come together and agreed, like, I'm just going to direct pass to you and then we're going to see what we can unlock, or they haven't quite worked on that vision of like, hey, this is what I like to do. I'm going to go this direction every single time. I'm going to like just pass it to the left of this defender and I'm going to run through it and catch it. Like, you do not see a lot of that we did see with Jack Paniotou. He would force the players to play into spaces that either they knew they could get to or maybe they weren't comfortable doing, but Jack could put the ball where it needed to happen. With this midfield, they're very good about collecting. They always will do the safe pass, which I'm completely fine with. That's why we have the record we have, and that's important. But we do not very often look for that like cut line pass or that long ball that isn't something over the top for JJ Williams to collect and try to do something with.
Yeah, this team relies on one of two things to really kind of stretch and move the field, and that is either us winning a long ball towards one of the forwards, or it is our wingbacks kind of dragging the field. This kind of goes back to like the Brito thing we talked about earlier in the season, where they look better when they are moving towards the net, as opposed to when you just try and build up from the back there. It's a lot of static bodies not knowing where to go. If you can make a pass out wide and Joje can move it forward and he can go ahead of his man, all of a sudden you are dragging back the Loudon or whoever it is that we're playing at the time, their defense, right? So then their midfielders and their back line, and that opens up spaces for the other players. If that's not working on the night, then we saw what we saw this last game, where there were lots of opportunities where the team kind of just stood there, and that, you know, they did a very good impression of like, this is our lineup. We, you know, we're playing in our spaces, but we are not open and we're not changing that and being like flexible and kind of flowing as well as they can.
Right, which is why we saw the draw, the 0-0 here, which, you know, let's move to this. The draw king record inching closer and closer, but should we have won this game?
I'd say yes and no. To give up, you know, we didn't talk too much about Loudon, but they did have some good opportunities. And to give up those chances that we did and to walk away with that draw, that clean sheet, on top of squandering our own chances, maybe it's just... there was a bit of luck here. It seems like neither team was kind of quote unquote on it in terms of their finishing. You know, there was that one opportunity where like they had a ball right in front of Koke and just completely whiffed it and went out of bounds. And like, you know, that they had at least three or four opportunities where they could have scored. I think they actually outperformed us in XG, I think, this match, right?
They did, yeah.
So, you know, like we mentioned earlier, I don't want to say we're in like a rut. Maybe it's just like a mini blip where we have two draws in a row, only one goal between those two matches. You know, it's at the end of the day, it's a draw. We'll take that point. We're getting closer to the record. As long as we get it figured out this weekend, you know, I don't think we are going to have any other problems.
So then should I ask a different question? And should I ask, are we a better team than Loudon?
That's hard to say. I think this was a bit of a mirror match in some ways, that we can be very similar. You know, there's still, what, 9 games left in the season? Or 8, maybe?
Okay, we'll find out. I'm not sure myself, like I said in the preview of Loudon. They're this sneaky team that they do well at certain times, and they completely flop on others, and I don't think they put in a bad performance at all. I still think it was our game to win. I think you're right that luck did not go our way, or maybe it was a reversion to the mean of we've overproduced on our conversions of XG, where we, like, I just can think of Jojea on that goal he scored where I'm pretty sure he was behind the goalpost and still somehow got that ball in. So maybe this is just like a counter as we revert back to that.
Yeah, as we kind of finish out the season here, I think we'll see where we line up. We do have them again. They are Eastern Conference opponents, so we do get to play them again at home. You know, maybe it's just some craziness, but they did beat Tampa Bay Rowdies twice, home and away. Yeah. Have not made, hey, maybe when the Rowdies come to visit us, maybe we'll beat them.
Yeah. So we'll do a special separate video for, just for the sake of time tonight, we'll do a separate video on the USL inaugural performances. I think there's gonna be some really interesting surprise there, but right now, if we hold on to the projections that we do have, we are looking to end the season with a 13-15-6 record. So 13 wins, 15 draws, and 6 losses. We asked the listeners and any other one else that wanted to participate on Twitter what they thought that our average chance and point accumulation would be, and it was pretty even. There's some people, there's some doubters, and there's some believers, and there's some people that are sitting on the fence right now. But we tied on the belief that we will either end up in fourth place with 54 points, or we will end up in fifth place with 49 points. What's really interesting, though, is that that is a 5-point gap, and it only flips us by one position. It's an important position because right now, by the USL tactics, by John Morrissey's projections, that means we would be facing Detroit City FC. Having said that, it's whether we face them at home or away. Frankly, I'm not really in love with either one of those options.
Yeah.
The USL League... The Champions League did the championship did the, like, if we started the playoffs today, and right now they had a saddle against Charleston Battery, which I'm not in love with that one either. I'm basically not in love with any of the top three, but that's the circumstance that we're in right now. What was more fascinating, though, is that the people that believe we would take the last possible berth, which was eighth place, that would give us 47 points. So right now there's a 5-point gap potentially building between fourth and fifth, but then from fifth through eighth, the other four spots are going to be determined by 2 points. That means that there's probably going to be some serious look back on the other different tiebreaker mechanisms that exist this year. And that's a perfect segue because if depending on who you ask, we are either in seventh or eighth place. So I'm going to ask you to start things off. Jason, which one are we in? Because every normal stat tracker shows us as eighth, but the championship shows us in seventh place.
So I'll admit, just for ease of use, I generally check FOTMob and occasionally LiveScore, just because their interfaces are easier to use often. So I was thinking, oh yeah, we're in eighth place. And then, if you go check out the USL Championships website, we're actually in seventh. And I think the reason why there's this weird confusion is because the rules that USL Championship uses are not the norm for most other leagues. So I imagine in the APIs for FOTMob and LiveScore, they just have the generic, like, well, it's points, and if it's not that, it's goal difference and or wins. But USL Championship has a interesting kind of hoops you have to jump through to decide whether or not you are ahead in positions. So in terms of the standing, RIFC jumped one spot to seventh place. We're on a 7-13-5 record with 34 points. RIFC now only has one win in the last 5 matches, which doesn't sound great. We're glass half full. RIFC is undefeated in 3 consecutive matches.
That's
and unbeaten
how you sell it.
In the last 5 home matches.
Oh, even better. Yeah, that's exactly how you sell it. So wait, before you go there, did we move PPG?
Yeah, so that's Loudon. That's the weird thing here. So RFC is currently at 1.36 points per game, but that's for the entire season. When it comes to tiebreakers, it's in conference. So if we look at just the conference, the division, however you want to refer to that, RFC's at 1.53 points per game. Loudon was at 1.36 points per game before we played them and dropped to 1.33. So either way, we're better than that because that's in terms of the conference. But because we hadn't played each other, the tiebreaker that was used was regular season wins.
I feel like they put that rule in backwards. It should always be game in hand first and then PPG, because our PPG is higher with one extra game played. I feel like that's a very backwards rule to implement.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why they do this. Maybe, you know, if it saves some teams, you know, like if it comes...
Because why wouldn't we have a potential higher PPG if we've played more games? It could hurt us too if we've lost them. But if we have the same amount of wins and ties, but you have an extra game, you should get the benefit of that being like a 3-point PPG, because that's what you consider a game in hand. Like it's 3 potential points that you haven't dropped yet or you haven't earned. So it's like, it's interesting that it's not, because at the end of the season, it doesn't matter. You've all played your number of games. So in the regular season, it should be, should be an 8. USL is weird.
Yeah.
But
just like you said earlier, like, hey, I'll take it, but this is kind of weird. We probably should be an 8th in any other league.
But hey, I will say this then, though. If that's really what is happening here, that is the most powerful nil-nil like impact I've ever seen. Like a nil-nil draw having the ability to swing two teams that were in the exact same position prior. It's the most powerful draw we'll ever get.
I would love the conundrum of both of our matches are nil-nil draws, and then somehow we're also tied. You know, like what kind of weird stats are they going to come up with to decide that stuff?
Is PPG the last one?
It keeps going down.
Right.
But like if you have literally had some sort of weird mirror match situation.
Right. Like the 10th or 11th tiebreaker is who had the most weather delay minutes. And then like who had to pay the most for parking. It just gets weirder and weirder.
Yeah. To wrap out our standing segment here real quick, playoff watch. So there's a 3-point difference between 4th and 8th place, which is... it was just nuts. Pittsburgh's on our tail. They've kind of started to slowly get better.
I hate that they're getting hot when we're about to face them.
Yeah, we're going to face them again. I don't like that either. But they've also have played 2 more matches than us at this stage. So that could be a kind of false position. They're away to Indy, who's currently a point ahead of us. Loudon, who we're tied with on points but ahead on PPG, is hosting Phoenix. Detroit has Hartford. And then we are going to play Birmingham Legion again.
Yeah, and Birmingham in a very shaky scenario right now for themselves. They're coming off of 2 straight losses where they also failed to score, which is never a great run of form as you're coming in to face the mighty, mighty Rhode Island FC. Right now, the Legion are on a 10-5-10 record. Symmetry strikes back. They've got 25 points on the season where they are 1 point ahead of us on the same number of matches played. And I said 25, I meant 35 there. So 35 points. So we're neck and neck right now. This game isn't just a 6-point swing. This game will determine a lot of things when it comes to what's going to happen on the night. So let's get into this preview of your Rhode Island FC against Birmingham Legion. Starting things off with Haravo as the quote-unquote only suspicious player on the injury list. We saw him today in training photos and in training videos. His boot was off. He was running. But that doesn't mean contact. Remember, when you're going through the mechanics of getting back to quality minutes, it's first it's assessment, then it's like light running and training, and then it's light contact, and then it's full contact. Obviously, this didn't sound like it was a major injury, especially if Zach got it at Detroit City and then played 2 games, including the performance at Hartford for the El Clamico. So maybe this is just he needed the time to quickly heal it and then move back. So I would probably, Coach alluded to that it would be 1 to 2 games. We found out at Oakland that puts this as his return is possible. I don't think we see him get a start if he needs the little, like if he needs to be a little delicately handled. I could see him potentially being a substitute off the bench, but just in case, I always err on the side of caution. Now, this could also be, you know, Amos Shapiro Thompson could start to find a way into this team. It'll be very interesting to see how that lines up. But in terms of the starting 11, we got a little bit of feedback this week on this one, but I'm going to walk people through it. And this was all decided before the Jojea announcement. So people were like, what insider information do you have? I mean this when I say if I learned anything, it's usually on Fridays. It's always after we record. That's why I've always called this wrong Wednesday, because I know we've gotten it right like once or twice on the season. And it's not just my decisions. I work diligently with Jason to make sure he takes equal blame in these poor decisions. So we do have the 3-5-2. I think we still see Dugan, who put on a great performance last week. Because of the clean sheet, I don't think you touch the back three. I think you reward them for that performance. So I don't see Nodarse getting a start on this game yet either. I think what's going to happen is the next time we see a defender, like the defenders are playing for their lives, knowing that there's a quote unquote better player waiting to replace them. So I don't think you see him in the starting 11. And then the one that I got the most flack for was in the midfield five. I've got Turnbull, Holstead, Ibarra, Fuson, and I've got Gabby Alves returning to glory, returning to glory on this game with Doyle and Chico up front with this, the rut that's going on with JJ Williams. So the reason for Doyle, we already talked about, he's performing as needed, but the Alves insertion, I think that this is something that people need to understand. We've tried to hint at it, but a couple of things are going on all at once. One, this is Birmingham Legion, right? This is Gabby Alves' last team that he played for before coming to Rhode Island FC. Second, he played, and I don't mean like occasionally. I mean, he played. He was in the guts of the Marshall system playing side by side with Dugan every single game. And Marshall was one of the top three performance colleges when it comes to their soccer program. Jackson Lee would argue with that a little bit, but that's nevertheless the case. So you've got an Alves who's like itching to get back in and earn his spot. He's got the symmetry or the synergy with Dugan. He has the history against facing a team like Birmingham Legion, who has not changed a lot from the last season where he played and knows Coach Sohn's system. I think it makes sense. In addition to it, I'm going to say Jojea Quizera did not have the best game last week. He had a yellow card. He did draw the foul, which for the penalty, which I don't think was a penalty. But even in the moments he was in the game, he looked a little slower. Like, he could get the ball up the field, but he couldn't seem to set up his crosses. He had the same problem kind of showcasing against Oakland as well, where his play wasn't as crisp, it wasn't as clean. And so I don't say Quizera's losing a step, but you can definitely tell that coach seems to favor a pull-in lever system where he kind of almost gives one wing back the authority to go up and play like in space and in distance, and then he kind of keeps the other one tucked at times to like bridge the gap between the back part of the midfield and the back three. And I don't know that Quizera has necessarily been in the peak condition that we saw like earlier in that game of that streak of eight games unbeaten. So for me, if you're coming off of two draws and one of them was a 0-0 and it was from a midfielder that didn't really help and kind of almost cost you the game, is now a time, especially if you know he may be going to Rwanda to play for the national team?
Yeah.
Is now the time to try that out?
Especially with that coming up, you're going to want to get Gabby some minutes so that he can be quote unquote fresh, right? Because there's that potential here where he could, you know what, Quizera could miss 2-3 games. So might as well give him some rest, let him, you know, reward him, get prepared for his call up, and then let's just see what Gabby can do. The only thing that I'm not 100% sure on is I wouldn't be surprised if also JJ Williams just comes back in
because of the Birmingham, because he was a Tampa Bay guy.
No, I know,
you
but
just think
like,
it's JJ's turn to try again.
Maybe it's just kind of because none of them themselves have, like I said, Doyle has that better passing, and maybe some of this is coach challenging him to like be better and then say, okay, I'm going to start you. But if you're not putting, you know, good performance out, you know, second half, I'm going to bring Doyle in.
Okay. I mean, it'll be, like I said, I'm not, so
yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Speculation here.
That's the beauty of like the disclaimer for that. Do you want to take a shot at the name pronunciations? I totally flipped. I was supposed to read these and I totally jumped the gun because I was so excited to talk about my theory. Do you want to take a shot? Or
yeah,
you want me to
go
read
for
these
it.
Two? All right, here we go. Announcer Jason. Here we go.
So in net, we're probably going to see Van Oekel in that back line. We're going to have Patterson, Cronally, Kavita, and Dodson in that kind of in a 4-1-4-1 situation here with that lone holding midfielder, Hernandez Foster. Out on the left, you're going to have McCartney, Martinez. This is the only hard one. Zoe here, maybe. And then Rufe out wide on the right. And then a lone striker, Pino, up top.
Yeah, first of all, you could take my job anytime now at that point. I think the things to watch out for, especially if you follow Kaylor Hodges, he had a very, it was a very, kind of broke my heart to hear his most recent podcast because Birmingham is not in a great spot. But before we get into that, just talk about the formation. I don't think he would agree 100% on what's going on. There's some weapons off the bench that that Kaylor is frustrated are not being used appropriately, which we'll talk about in a second. The real big ones that, you know, are questionable on the night on whether we got this right is Dodson. He's coming back from an injury. And then also Zuhir. The reason I have him in there is he's a midfielder. It doesn't really fit. They've got plenty of midfielders. But the problem is that he's on loan from Montreal. So I feel like if MLS is going to loan a player down to you, they expect him to be playing. So I at least see him getting the start and then Coach Sohn saying, hey, I gave you 40 minutes. You didn't do anything with it. It just as much could be Prosper Kasim, who scored against us in the first leg of this matchup. But this is kind of what we think is the most likely event of what we'll see on the night. Let's get into this Birmingham game. Like, either this team is suffering from some major imposter syndrome or they are just completely unlucky at home. But either way, the Legion's a better team when they're not playing at Protective Stadium. And I'm pretty sure the fans are ready to riot.
Yeah, a lot of people have been unhappy with this away success and home failure. They're starting to whisper something needs to be changed. Like you'd mentioned, Kaylor's kind of been unhappy with some of it and they can't figure out, is it the coach? Is it the stadium? Or is something else going on? Especially after their coach recently commented that they've hit rock bottom, which doesn't feel like it considering, you know, like Miami exists.
And especially when you're ahead of us on the table, it's like, how dare you?
Yeah, but they kind of have been in that, like, just floating, almost like ready for a free fall kind of situation.
Yeah, and it's not fair because when I went back and watched the tapes, I looked at the stats. Birmingham, they're not a great team, but they're not a bad team. I mean, like you said earlier, the symmetry, it's that 10-5-10. If anything, they're a very predictable team. And what I mean by that is they kind of really only have one play style, and that is it's long balls. And it's fascinating because it's not like over the top necessarily. They have a lot of good long ball accuracy on like cutting lines. Their center back pairings, if their fullbacks aren't running up the field, their center backs know how to split midfields apart and just find passing sequences. Kaylor said himself on his most recent episode of Hammering Down that the reason that they don't get to call themselves a through and through long ball team though is because they don't have the speed to collect some of the like brilliant passes that are happening on the night. But it's a strategy that like Tom Sohn is like, he's not changing. Like, and I don't know if that's a bad thing. Like it reminds me of Lily Ball and like how everyone says Bob Lilly has one style and like, that's it.
But hey, shout out to him. He got his 400th win recently. That's impressive.
There you go. And so I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure for fans, they're going to say it's a bad thing because you have a coach who the record isn't great at home. And I understand that like nothing is worse than like when you're trying to convince a casual fan to show up and you don't get the results your way, right? Even watching a nil-nil performance away, I bet you there are people that went to the bar because they don't have ESPN Plus or Nesson. They went out and like, I spent 3 hours. I spent like $16 to $50 on, you know, food and drink, and I watched a nil-nil performance against a team that I'm not sure I could point to Loudon as a location on the map. So I get it. It's tough. But overall, like whether you hate Coach Sohn's strategy or not, it is working for them, right? They have their top 10 for a lot of things, but specifically in accurate long balls per 90, they're at fifth with 30.3. Accurate passes per 90, they're at seventh at 355. Big chances, total of 56 on the season, at ninth, higher than us. And then they have a lot of shooting opportunities at 4.6 shots per game, and that's eight. So, like, they're getting looks. They're getting chances. They're creating something out of nothing. The problem really becomes in the weapons or the tools that they have on the table. And maybe this is where Coach Sohn deserves the most kind of, like, ill will towards him, is that in terms of not changing his tactics, that's fine. I mean, we've seen Coach Kano, like, we're a 3-5-2 till we die. But Coach Sohn doesn't want to play certain players that others who watch the league have said is the Achilles heel as to why maybe they're not getting the results that they want.
Yeah, the Legion are in a rough spot right now in terms of injuries. They've got five injured goalkeepers. Both of their holding midfielders are out, and their only, like, official quote-unquote number nine is hurt as well. Kaylor Hodges is kind of concerned about, like, there's a disconnect between the midfield and the attack. That's why you've seen, like, Enzo Martinez, who's traditionally, like, a winger.
He's a very good player, by the way.
Playing a little more centrally and, like, trying to link up with Hernandez Foster. You know, last season, Tabert Ataka-Preston did pretty well for them up top, but he is not really getting the chance. I mean, we've talked about how, you know, Kaylor is a bit down on them right now. I mean, he still thinks, all in all considered, that, like, he's done a good job, but that maybe a bit of stubbornness is kind of holding them back right now.
Yeah, and like you said, unfortunately, this team has some major scoring problems, right? And whether that's because of this missing number nine or the misuse of Tepertekka Preston, this team, like us, has spread the goals very far and wide. But unlike us, we've kind of risen the tide together with all of our players. Like, we're all, like, two or three goals collectively. They've sprinkled their goal production out, but most of their contributions have, like, seven or more, they've come from just four players. And you can say what you want about Rhode Island FC, but, like, every single one of our players is dangerous. You can't take them for granted when they're on the pitch.
Yeah, if you give Stephen Turnbull too much space in the box, like, he can score.
He'll make you pay. And that's not really the case for Birmingham right now. Whether it's injuries or not, you've got Pino, you've got Martinez, you've got Pasher, and I think there's one other one. Oh, Kasim. Those are the only productions that are really existing in any kind of major outlet when it comes to goal contribution. You do have these opportunities to see brilliance between the combinations of the like, but if something's not firing on the night for them, that's where this, like, we said this in the earlier preview with Kaylor, that it's like feast or famine, right? Like, you're either getting a goal or you're probably not producing anything on the night in terms of goal production. And when you don't have something to work on with, like, Prosper or Tabertekka, like, it becomes a situation. And so I can't answer why they are struggling offensively, but I can say that where they are shining a little bit better is in their defensive midfield actions. Now, that also comes off the heel of what you mentioned, how some of their injuries now may be plaguing these stats long term. But and it's also very apparent when you look at, like, the fact that they're a -6 goal differential, which it's fascinating to me that they have negative goal differential and they're higher than us on the table. I love stats like that. But because of that, you know, they are really good at controlling the tempo of a game in that midfield, whether it's the, like, deliberate start and stop, it's the hack, it's the tactical foul, it's the hold up play. Like, full credit to Hernandez Foster on what he's been able to do this season. And also to the fact that, like, where Coach Sohn has tried to implement different players, he's bringing defenders further up and midfielder opportunities or wing back opportunities. So there's a very defensive first mindset with the Legion right now. And that's probably why they've done so well away on the road, is that they know they have to hold on for dear life. So they're playing defensive first. If you're a home team trying to produce in front of your fans, you're probably putting a little bit additional pressure on yourself, and you maybe overexpose yourself or make a mistake that you can't scramble back from. So it's interesting to see. And so you've got this, like, defensive minded shape. And then you do have, to your point, this, like, technical masterclass when it comes to, like, Martinez connecting with McCartney. And I looked at it as, like, you have the anvil on one side, and then you got the hammer on the other, and that's how you get the Birmingham Legion. I'm done here, folks. My jokes are done for the night.
You didn't.
Oh, I did. I did. But listen, like this team isn't bad. It's just like Loudon to a certain extent. If it wasn't for the fact that they were doing so good at home, I would write this off immediately. I was like, we've got this in the bag. We cannot, even with our striking and scoring problems, like this is a no-brainer. They somehow just get this done on the night.
Yeah. And if we move on here to talking about some players to watch, which was funny. I forgot we had Kaylor on last time. So I was looking for our old notes.
How could you forget the legend?
No. I just, that like, I was looking for the old notes to be like, you know, just copy my own homework.
Oh yeah. Kaylor just,
but Kaylor's, I heard it's like, oh yeah, he did it for us.
So fun fact about Kaylor, and I won't get too much into his life, but when he was on the pod, he had an emergency and he like,
it turned out okay.
Yeah. Everything's fine. But he gave us the signal like, hey, things are not all well in Denmark right now. And we were like 15 minutes like shy of the ending. And we were like, okay, what do we do? And like, he did not prioritize incorrectly. I want to make sure we all agree that Kaylor Hodges is an incredible human being, but he is just a trooper of a human being. Like we need to protect Kaylor Hodges at all costs, especially if Birmingham Legion is the team that ends up going away, which I don't think it is, but if it is, we need to protect Kaylor Hodges at all costs.
Yeah, he's great. Back to the players to watch for. So Enzo Martinez, not the Argentine from Chelsea, but the Uruguayan from Birmingham. He's got 4 goals and 3 assists to his name so far. Not as high as some previous year's returns, but it's nothing to scoff at. He is a very talented player. Part of that might be because he is not playing out wide. He's kind of, you know, playing different positions here. But he is a very hard worker. He's been trying to link that midfield to the attack. You know, if RAFC is able to neutralize him, it's going to be a big blow to the Legion's offense there.
Yeah, and then I've got Kobe Hernandez-Foster. We kind of just talked about it a second ago, but he is the center midfielder. He's the individual where all balls come to start their journey away from the back line, or they stop with him. He's oftentimes the holding midfielder, but he's always looking to recover or intercept the ball, and I think that's a credit to why the midfield has been so successful on the season with them. He's got a goal and 3 assists, so he's no stranger to the attacking side, but it's definitely not his aspect, if you will. It's a part of his game, but it's not the majority of it. The one thing I'll say is if he's afforded too much time on the ball to pass and dictate play, RIFC could be looking at a long night ahead of them. So one of the things they need to make sure is that he is not captaining or a maestro trying to build an attack or stop a promising attack one way or another.
And then last player here, Dawson McCartney, came from MLS Next Pro with Timbers 2 and I think Philadelphia Union 2 also. He's been playing as a left winger, but he's spent some time in a few other midfield positions, such as against us, he was right center mid in a 4-3-3, and he actually got the assist on the goal against us. He's got 3 goals, 4 assists to his name. He's another threat that RFC is going to have to watch out for.
So, you know, we can talk all night about why Birmingham is doing what they're doing and the troubles they're in. But what do they have to do to take points from us, or what do we have to do to take all 3 on the night?
For RAFC, you know, we've talked about slight struggles in the last 2 matches. But if we look back on those, overall the performances were good. Maybe a few more shots on target could have helped, but I think all in all, those were good matches. So you want to have that like short term memory. You don't want to dwell on that too much. Just play your game and just trust that the forwards are kind of gonna work through their rut and get it done. You know, earlier we talked about a little more movement off the ball maybe could help in terms of trying to break down opponents if they are not allowing us to go out wide. But maybe that's like a long-term tactic for coach to work on so that we're not just wing play FC.
So be a goldfish and find our wings. Okay. Got it. On my side, I mean, it's more of the same. Finish your chances. When you're 5 feet from the box, you gotta put those in. The interesting thing, when I look back on like who was responsible for the victory, who confirmed or secured the win for Rhode Island FC, it was Zach Erivo with his, you know, never before seen brace in the league. And if he's on the bench at all, we are not seeing a
brace.
That
was also Fusan's 55-second goal.
Yes, yes. So we are not seeing a Erivo brace on the night. This, I don't think. So it's all about being clinical in your opportunities. And I think if we can just convert the XG that we earn for ourselves, I think that we should be okay. The only other thing I would say is that the keeper, Matt Van Okel, is not the same keeper that we faced off against in Alabama. So I don't know much about Van Okel's stats in comparison to the multiple injuries that have happened this season. He seems to be competent, and I can imagine that this will offer a little bit tougher of a test on our goal scoring abilities. So that's something to look out for. And then in terms of defense, you know, again, whoever that back line is, you got to watch out for the long balls, whether they're in the air, they're cut passes, they're direct. This team is going to try to cut our defensive shape in half and find something out of nothing. It's going to be an interesting night. I think that's where we'll see the opportunities. I don't think there'll be a lot from them. They've struggled to score, and their XG hasn't been too great, including like no shots and on some games. So I think that this is possible to get the clean sheet potentially. I don't want to jinx it, but I'm feeling good. Rhode Island FC fans are feeling great about themselves right now, coming off of the 0-0 draw. They've got a 75% win vote on who's going to pull off the results on this game. DraWKings, this is the lowest DraWKings I've seen in the history of DraWKings, 3%. So that means it has to happen now at this point, right? Like you can't disrespect the DraWKings gods.
People must be just so down on Birmingham that they just...
You think those are Birmingham fans? Just like, no, just put us out of our misery.
And as homie.
and Birmingham Legion has a 22% chance to win. This game has very big impacts right now. It gets us into a deeper position to jump Birmingham and put a 5-point spread between us in terms of the table, because, you know, 3-3, that would be because they're up by 1 or 2. No, it'd be a 4-point spread. Sorry, can't do math tonight. So the opportunity is here. And then also, though, with that flip, it does start to put Birmingham, it starts to push them out of the playoffs. So there's a lot on the kind of at stake tonight for these players to be playing on Saturday night, excuse me. So that being said, I'm still winning 16-12 to the Hillside's 9. He argued on the Discord that this was the wrong projection. I don't believe him. So I'm gonna, until we have a conversation, he's at 9 points. I'm going to go first. I think we get the repeat. I think it's another 3-1 win, just like we had at home. I don't think we're infallible, and I think that whatever is missing from our shooting boots, whether it's the laces or something else, we're going to find the right pair, and we're gonna score 3 goals. I don't know who it's going to come from, but we're going to score 3-1.
I think this is going to be a tough match, fairly physical, but I think ultimately RAFC is going to get it done. I think that the team defensively has grown, and I think we can get some more clean sheets in the heading out. So I'm going to go with 2-0. Also, if RAFC win this, we will now have a better home record than we do away,
which is huge. The Hillside, he's all in at 4-0. So he thinks this is going to be a smash. I have up on the screen, it's very interesting, the Hillside's predictions have all been right with the exception of the Indy game. The table that has us at the strongest point accumulation at 54 points at the end of the season has been spot on the entire time since we started tracking. So we've now seen 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 performances all accurately guessed by that system. So, you know, all three tables and data points show that this is a win. So at this point then, because I've jinxed it so heavily, it's obviously going to be a draw, and we'll get to tying that 14th record. But either way, super excited to see that happen. I guess, Jason, let's jump into these questions.
Yeah. So
you ready for this?
Let's see, what do we got here?
So Bob asks, any idea what week in September the non-premium Tidewater ticket prices will be announced? And is there any scuttlebutt as to whether there will be seats under $20 like Burn? What's your inside scoop tell you?
I don't have any knowledge, but I have faith in RAFC that they are not going to they're not going to burn their fans. I think that they're, you know, I don't have the insider knowledge, but I believe fans will be happy with the prices that will come out.
I can double down. I don't know the exact date, but we do know we've been told September. So whether that's the first week or the tail end of the month, no way of pointing that down. But imagine that it is coming in September. So I can't answer that. But I do know the pricing. I have seen it with my eyeballs. And I am not going to confirm or deny any dollar amount like this $20 situation at Burn. Obviously, this is a bigger stadium. It's a bigger deal. But when I tell you that I think fans are going to be very excited about the pricing strategy and approach, I think that's as much as I can tease and hint to. But I was excited to see it. I thought it was a very good strategy. And that could have been just a trick. They could have said, hey, here you go, and then changed their minds. So we'll see what happens. But I think fans are going to be super excited for what they see in September with the release of the rest of it.
Well, that's good to hear.
All right. Susan writes in, do you know when Koke's baby is due?
I do not. When was this announced? It feels like 2 or 3 months.
So I don't know so just when, but I know that they had the baby shower, and as two men talking about that kind of stuff,
I've been to so many baby showers.
Right. Like how many months before the baby is born do you have the shower? What's the etiquette there?
I don't know.
Yeah, we're not gonna guess. Let's just say that if you know that, I think the baby shower was about 2 to 3 weeks ago. So for any of the smarter people than us, do the calculations.
It's probably coming up sometime soon in the fall.
Terrace writes in, will Haravo be ready to play this weekend?
I wouldn't be surprised if he's on the bench, but I don't know if we're going to see him get any minutes. I think that we're more likely to see a Amos Shapiro Thompson. Oh, like,
don't tease. Don't do that to the
like
listeners.
Like a small... This is just me speculating. I think we're more likely to see him get a few minutes than we are to see Haravo.
You're a cruel, cruel person for even teasing that we'll get to see an AST sighting on the pitch before September 1st. They said it would never be done. All right. Tim writes in, would you rather see RFC not tie another game all season, but get that home playoff berth, or set the ties record that cements them as the draw kings forever, but have to play any playoff games on the road?
Oh, that's a tough one.
There's a darker timeline where we get like 25 draws and we don't make the playoffs, Tim. But for your example.
Because when you say not tie another game all season.
Means that we don't get the record.
That also means that
we could
those ties now become losses. And I think.
There's two more that we have projected. So
honestly, I'd rather get the draw kings. I think Louisville and Charleston are just way too strong this season that even getting into the playoffs, we're maybe gonna like win one match depending on how well we do.
You know, that's actually interesting because I didn't even think about this until just now. The beauty of questions, if we get the home playoff match and then we lose in front of fans, could that have like
that would probably
deeper implications than like, hey, we tried first year, congratulations, we got this record, you'll never take that from us. But then we lost, you know, to the Battery on the road. Like, that's a good point.
Yeah, I'd rather
let us know what you think.
Yeah, take the draw kings, you know, and then whatever happens, happens.
I'll answer this one, but Andrew Q writes in, where's the team training next year? They're training in Rhode Island, Andrew. That that's where they're going to be training.
Got him.
But, no, I do know a little bit. I have to be careful what I say because a lot of it was said off the record. But the intention is that they will probably, once the weather is favorable, be training at Tidewater. Like, there's no reason not to. It's a turf field, so they're not going to be beating it up a bunch. The question that comes in is, what will they be doing their preseason when it's not at like a camp in Florida or hopefully back in Bermuda again? I don't have that answer yet. Tim, super rap fan, Tim extraordinaire, found that the team has already registered a training center LLC, so there is one that will come at some point. But just given the primary urgency around getting Tidewater deployed, I don't think it'll be anything other than that for the season. So it'll probably be like the Worldwide Sports Center in Smithfield, and then it'll be, when the weather's favorable, training on the pitch at Tidewater. It'll be difficult, though, I think, too, even though it's our stadium, if they're planning on having all of these multi-purpose venue situations. I mean, if you're trying to get 200 things going a year, that has to kind of compete with on-field training at times. So I'll be curious if like they have to train somewhere else. There was some theory. There's the Max Field down the street. If they'll like just do some practice there, like light practice at some point. Don't know. But the long-term strategy beyond this next year is that they will have a training facility at some point. Steven writes in, really appreciate your player interviews. Keep up the good work. Can you spill the beans on who is next?
I don't know. Can you?
Yeah, no, I can do that. So we have Mark Ibarra on, he'll be on nice. Monday. We'll have him for a, interview special. So Mark is joining the pod. If you have any questions, submit them to the Twitter, to the Discord, and we'll try to see if we can incorporate them into the interview. So Mark Ibarra will be joining us on the next one. And then Jen writes in, will the goalkeeper kit be available again? I missed my chance to get one. A lot of people miss their... I think that's the number one thing that people are saying right now. Like, where did you get that kit and why can't I find one?
I don't have any insider knowledge, but based upon a lot of the other availability of merch this season, I'm going to say this year, probably not. But considering the amount of people who were interested in it, I bet that the team is thinking about next year selling it.
I completely agree, and I've already heard rumors that they're looking into bringing that along with... They have a lot of kit designs that they already have ready to kind of produce, so I don't know if they're going to automatically just have a third kit ready and then release it later into the summer, because Capelli needed to bring the production lines on. It's a first season club. Capelli's trying to grow their brand as well, so no answer yet, but I think we may see another run, especially if they don't have to change much to the design, because it's just the badge. They don't have the rest of the artwork, and we know Breeze is carrying over. So expect some more answers. Maybe they'll get smart and figure something out for Christmas. That's a good push to get additional merch and season ticket membership sold. So we'll find out more there. In the meantime, let's get out of here. It's been fun talking to you, but we got things we got to go do outside of being podcasters. So the Birmingham Legion are set to take on your Rhode Island FC in the return leg here this weekend on Saturday, August 31st at 7:30 p.m. If you can't make the game, you can watch all of the action on NESN Plus and ESPN. I will say, though, for those people that have still not bought tickets but have been looking to buy tickets, I'm going to put an overlay up on the visual for the match right now, and you can use that QR code to buy some tickets at a great price if you want. So if you've been holding out, use that QR code and you can come join us at the game. What's going on next, though, Jason?
And then RFC is on the road for two consecutive away games as they head off to square against the Pittsburgh Riverhounds on Saturday 9/7 at 7 p.m. The official watch party is at West Rib House in Providence, or come hang out with Defiant 1636 at the Guild in Pawtucket. If you can't come in person, the game will be available on NESN and ESPN+.
And don't forget to rate us, subscribe us. You actually helped us grow the Facebook group so we could start live streaming there. We appreciate all of the support and fandom that you give us. Making sure we get to see all of your beautiful faces sustains us. We really appreciate all that you guys do. And we do this for you guys. We couldn't do this without you. And we appreciate you guys every step of the way.
Yeah, thank you guys. You're the best. Make sure to check out our friends over at the Blazing Musket for all of your New England soccer coverage, including RIFC, at theblazingmusket.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Threads, and TikTok at RIFC Podcast. Our Instagram handle is at Raising Anchor, and we have that website, www.raisinganchorpodcast.com.
Anchors up, and we'll see you guys on Saturday.
Anchors up. See you guys later.